This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let me read you a couple of quotes about my guest, the singer Betty LaVette. A couple of years ago, John Pareles wrote in the New York Times, at age 59, she is as eloquent as any soul singer alive. In writing about her new CD in Entertainment Weekly, the reviewer asked, quote, is there a more wrenching soul singer alive than Betty LaVette? If so, keep it to yourself, because I'm too wrung out from this CD's intensity to take anything more emotionally potent, unquote. So if you've never heard of Betty LaVette, you may be wondering why. There's a good reason. After a promising start in the early 1960s, when she had a couple of singles that became R&B hits, things just didn't work out for her. The 1972 album she recorded for Atlantic that was supposed to be her breakthrough wasn't released until 2000, when a French producer licensed it from Atlantic and started her comeback. In 2005, Joe Henry produced an album by her, and now Betty LaVette has a new album called The Scene of the Crime. Like her 1972 album, it was recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. The bass player from that 1972 album, David Hood, is featured on several tracks of the new one. His son, Patterson Hood, of the band The Drive-By Truckers, is featured on guitar and co-produced the album. Let's start with a song from the new CD, The Scene of the Crime. This song is called They Call It Love. That's Betty LaVette from her new CD, The Scene of the Crime. Betty LaVette, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk a little bit about the story behind this new CD, Scene of the Crime. You recorded it at the Fame Studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and you had recorded a 1972 album in Muscle Shoals for Atlantic Records that was never released. It's both a famous and infamous recording because of that. And we'll hear something from that a little bit later in the show. But did this feel like a reunion to you, or like a return for you, the end of a cycle for you, going back to Muscle Shoals to record?
No, it was closer to revenge than anything. I was the only one who could still fit into a size 6 who had a voice this strong. I recorded before at Muscle Shoals Sound Studios, and the crime that occurred actually happened in the offices of Atlantic Records here in New York. The only thing I did in Muscle Shoals was record the album that was never released, but I never saw those people again. Of course, you know, they went on to play on every hit record that came out for about 10 years running. And I never saw them again or heard from them again or anything. So there was no reunion to be had. I was, you know, it was a very, it was kind of a completion of something to me. It was kind of like, aha, I'm back. And I'm still strong and you didn't kill me.
How did you choose the songs on the new album?
I just chose them because I like them. I'm not a real artsy kind of person. I mean, I don't put a lot of thought and a lot of planning into it. I hear the song if I think I sound good on it, which is the only way reason I listen to songs. I listen to songs for me to sing. And if I like it and think I can sing it, then I sing it. If I have a gig, I do it on my show. If I have a recording session, I do it on the recording session. But I've always chosen all of my own songs, and that's because I know what I want to sing.
Now, what kind of places were you singing before starting your comeback in 2005?
Well, it it wasn't a lot of places. I was in Detroit, and I was working in little bitty places for $50 a night, and people were drunk or busy talking or dancing or whatever, and I was just around. But I wasn't doing any traveling much at all, just maybe, you know, the faithfuls in Europe who kept having me back there, trying to keep me alive, just from a love affair that started with me in 1965 over there. But I wasn't really working a lot at all. It was more people paying house notes and car notes and whatever for me than me being able to do anything.
So people were helping you with your own bills?
Oh, absolutely.
Were you angry at your lack of recognition?
Oh, for sure. It's not so much anger, but hurt. Because it's, you know, it's not, it's just being completely ignored. It's not like selling full of brushes or something. It's you you're selling. So when they don't buy it, they're saying, we don't like you. So it's not my product. We don't like you. So I it was very hurtful, very, very painful. If it wasn't for the people who were propping me up, and people constantly ask me, how are you able to hold on? It was people telling me, do not quit. Do not quit. I will pay this. I will give you that. I will go over here. Just people, sometimes whole families would give me stuff.
Well, I want to play another song from your new CD, and this is a Willie Nelson song called Somebody mm-hmm. Pick Up My Pieces. And I know a lot of Willie Nelson songs. I didn't know this one. How did you come across this one?
A friend in New Jersey is a guitarist, Lou Bavera, and he sung the song one night on his gig. I said, if I record again, I'm recording that.
Well, you really put yourself into this.
I like the song. I really, really like the song, and I am a Willie Nelson fan. I'm not a fan of very many people. Mostly, I just like to hear myself sing. But I like a few people, and Willie Nelson is one of the few.
Well, let's hear. This is the Willie Nelson song, Somebody Pick Up My Pieces, sung by Betty LeVette on her latest CD, The Scene of the Crime.
I want to be taken out of contention. I surrender my crown. Somebody pick up my pieces. I think I'm coming down. Well, I sure thought I had it, but Lord, it looks like it had me. 'Cause the thing I thought was heaven was just falling debris. I may not be crazy, but I sure got a hell of a start. Somebody come here and pick up my pieces. I think I'm falling apart.
Wow, that sounds great and really emotional. That's Betty LeVette from her new CD, The Scene of the Crime, a Willie Nelson song. Can you talk a little bit about, like, recording that? Do you remember the experience of doing it? Did it feel very emotional?
Oh, yeah. Well, the song, I mean, the very first time that I heard Lou sing it, it made me cry. I just loved the song immediately and identified with it. Certainly, here in this 46th year of this career, I feel like I've been broken all apart and put back together and the whole bit. So I identified with the song completely. But Patterson Hood always tells everyone, my first words when I came into the studio after recording it, I said, it's too slow and too low. It was just... So they said, no, that's what made it so pitiful, that it was so slow. My husband says it's the slowest song he's ever heard in his life.
And you are really reaching for those low notes. But so you thought it was too low, but it sounds very emotional because you do have to reach. And there's like that kind of stretch becomes like an emotional stretch.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It was, as I said, though, I love the song. So it was... good to do. It was good to sing.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned before, you grew up in Detroit. When did you start singing?
My parents sold corn liquor from the time they came from Louisiana to Muskegon, Michigan, where I was born, until about maybe 1958. And there was always a jukebox in our living room as opposed to a couch and stuff there in most people's living rooms. And so I was privy to a whole gang of songs. So I sung as soon as I could talk. My mother said I've always talked and sung like an adult. She said she used to talk baby talk to me to try to make me sound like a baby. But I pretty much always sounded like James Brown.
That's really funny. So what were the parties like when your parents sold the corn liquor and had the
Well, they weren't really parties. I mean, you know, there was no gambling or prostitution or any of that. People just come and dance and drink for a while. My mother, Louisiana is strictly alcohol and food. So my mother always had the food going. My father had the corn liquor going. And they would stand me sometimes on top of the jukebox, and I could sing along with the songs, blues songs.
Were they songs with meanings that you couldn't quite comprehend yet?
Oh, I didn't know anything about them at all. I mean, I was 18 months old when I first started singing. I first started talking about that point. But there were people, because it was segregation still. So if you came to a little town like Muskegon and you were black, you couldn't drop by a restaurant or a bar anytime you wanted to. So they came to my house. So I had the Five Blind Boys and the Pilgrim Travelers and the Soul Stirrers and all those people at my house.
Wow. Now, a lot of soul singers got started singing gospel in church, but I believe you were raised Catholic and didn't have gospel in your church.
Yeah, and I just told you that the people were drunk, so they were never prepared to go to church on Sunday. Yeah. You know, it's just like the people in Louisiana. They go to Mass, they get drunk, and they cook.
So what were, you mentioned some of the musicians who used to come to your house to eat and drink. What was some of the other music you were exposed to early on?
Well, it was, the gospel music, because they would, when they would get drunk, they would sing there at the house, the groups that came. But I don't remember, because it was more of a, it was more conservative. There weren't a lot of people who sung secular music, who sung blues music or whatever that came to my house, because there was always this drunk prayer type thing going. So we didn't have, there were no Sarah Vaughans or those kind of people, but of course they were on the jukebox and we listened to them. But the people who actually came to the house were chiefly gospel singers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Betty LaVette, and her latest CD is called The Scene of the Crime. Now, I'd like to go back to 1962. I believe this is the year you started recording.
Mm-hmm.
And you had, I believe it was your first record that became a hit on the R&B chart. My Man, He's a Loving Man. That was like your first 45, right?
Right.
Okay. So how did you, were what, 17 when you made this?
16.
16. How did you get to record so young?
It was in Detroit. That wasn't a difficult thing to do. Maybe getting on the Atlantic record label right away was something phenomenal. But in Detroit, every third person either sung, produced, or wrote, or had a record company. So it wasn't difficult at all in Detroit in 1962 to record. All you had to do was show up.
Who asked you to do it?
A young man whose name was Timmy Shaw, who was a local artist, a regional artist more or less. None of his records had ever been really big. And it wasn't a thing where he wanted me to sing. He was trying to cajole me into something else, but he said, I can make you a star, you know.
Oh.
So he introduced me to his manager and producer, Johnny Mae Matthews, who was one of the first female producers probably in the world and certainly the only black one. And she was producing him and everybody. She had everybody that Berry Gordy had at one time, but she was just such a crooked woman, she lost them all.
So you got the R&B hit. Did he get you? The guy who is using this as an excuse?
Well, I became a national artist, so that took me out of town.
Ah, right. Okay, so you escaped his clutches.
Yes.
So let's hear it. This is like your first hit, an R&B hit from 1962, and this is Betty LaVette. Treat me right. That's my man. He's a loving man. Betty LaVette, recorded in 1962. Betty, it sounds so low-tech. Describe what the recording session was like.
Well, it took about an hour. It cost about $100, maybe $20. And that was mostly in drinks for the musicians. The guitar player, I can't even think of Leroy's last name right now, but he was younger than me. And they actually snuck him out of his bedroom window to come to the recording session.
That's great.
And he's a really big local artist in somewhere in Canada now, but I have heard from him in the last 5 years since all of this has started to happen. But the other musicians, Timmy, the guy who had started the thing, played piano. And Johnny May and Timmy and her husband sung background. Of whatever background was sung. But it was just, it was just the most amazing thing in the world. It was just amazing. I was making a record. It was amazing. And then when they played it on the radio 5 days later, because you could just press it up and walk right into the radio station and say, you play this, and slip somebody $50 or $10 or whatever it was. And so when I heard it on the radio 5 days later, I just ran down the street screaming. I mean, nobody else in my eighth grade class had a record.
Eighth grade?
Well, I should have been about in the ninth grade, I guess, ninth or tenth grade.
But I wasn't.
I was recording.
What changed in your life immediately after the record started getting airplay?
Nobody in my family had ever been anywhere or done anything or had anything. And I was going someplace. They paid me. And I was doing something that was completely different from anything that had ever happened in my family. No one had ever had any education, any money, had never traveled, nothing. And all those people who were on that red and black label that I had seen so many years on the jukebox in my house and that I had danced so much after school to, I was on the road with them in like a matter of days.
Like who?
Clyde McFadder, Benny King.
The Drifters?
It was later before I worked with the Drifters. But Otis Redding. We were all, you know, because you tended to, companies tended to send a whole group of their artists around then. So all those people were on either Atlantic or one of their subsidiaries. And I guess Otis Redding and I were the brokest people there. He had the same little shoes and suit every night. And I had my two little gowns that I had. But everybody else, you know, I mean, Benny King had gotten big with the Drifters. Clyde McFadder had gotten big with the Drifters. Clarence Frogman Henry, who it was his very first big record, but it was bigger than mine and Otis's. And Barbara Lynn, it was her first big record, but she had been singing for a while. But I think the brokest people probably were me and Otis. And so that caused us to spend a lot of time together because we weren't the big stars.
What was he like? What was it like to know him?
He was the most wonderful person in the world. And when people say that, they're talking about the Otis Redding they know now. I don't know what he would be like now, or I don't know what he would be like as a legend. But then he was just a broke guy from Georgia who I didn't find very sophisticated and who loved me very much. But I was from Detroit, and blacks at the time felt that if they were born and raised in the North, were a little bit better than blacks who were born and raised in the South. So he just chased me around a lot, and I really kind of thought of him as just maybe one of the other guys who liked me. Had I known he was going to be Otis Redding, I probably would have acted a little better.
What'd you think of his singing then?
Oh, I just thought he was one of the greatest singers I've ever heard in my life, and still do. All the things that I thought about him that I thought wouldn't make him a great suitor, when he was on that stage, he looked different. He was just a totally different person on the stage.
I want to play another record that you recorded in 1962, and this is called You'll Never Change. And, you know, I mentioned how low-tech he's a loving man sounded. This sounds like much better recorded. And
Well, that was what you did then. The things that are given these artists today is just incredible to me. You had to earn a bigger band. You had to earn violins. You had to earn a huge band of your own. You didn't just have those things. And very few people sold like a billion records on their first try. But even if you did, you had to get one more and then they would make an album on you. You know, so all of it, I mean, by the time we did You'll Never Change, and I had maybe six pieces. And the Falcons were singing background on it. I was coming up. And then we got to the next one, and I got my little strings, child. You could be behind with a red apple.
Well, let's hear this 1962 track, You'll Never Change. This is Betty LeVette.
Don't promise me nothing if you can't stick to your word.
Stick to your word.
Don't blame me for something that you claim that you have heard.
Claim you have heard.
Don't leave me alone while you run around in the street. It's a pity and a shame, baby, you never change.
That's Betty LeVette from 1962, singing You'll Never Change. And Betty LeVette has a new CD, which is called The Scene of the Crime. Now, I have to say, you know, this song that we just heard was not an R&B hit, but I think it's like, it's so good. Like, why is it
but
that
You'll
the,
Never Change?
Yeah, why is it that this didn't chart and the other one did?
It was 1963. I don't know. I have no idea. Most of the things that did not work, I guess, the only thing I can really, in retrospect, attribute them to is that the companies didn't like them and they didn't feel that they were strong enough to put their money behind. I don't know anything else to say. They never gave me any explanation.
So they didn't promote it, is that what you're saying?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
What were your expectations for this record that we just heard?
Oh, I thought I was going to be a huge star. I mean, I the first one had done so well, I thought this one will be the one that will get me on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Now, how did you manage to sing like you do, grow up in Detroit, and not get snapped up by Motown Records?
When I started singing, Berry Gordy wanted to be with Atlantic. No, Motown was just a little local company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that isn't even where I was trying to go. I was trying to go to New York. That's where everybody was trying to go. That was why Mary Wells left Motown or Marv Johnson. We were all trying to go to New York. Berry Gordy was trying to go to New York. You know, so it wasn't anything to be with Motown when I first started singing. And when they did start to get big, I was in New York and with a big company in New York. So it was years before I wanted to be with Motown because they kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and doing better and better. And I was doing worse and worse. And since I knew everyone there, then I wanted to be there. And I did eventually sign with them briefly.
This was in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
So who did you know at Motown?
I didn't know anyone there then except...
No, I mean in the 60s.
Oh, everybody. I mean, everybody that was over there. That was segregation. There was a time, you know, when all blacks really did know each other. I mean, they really did because there were just everywhere. If you went out to dinner, you were at the same place that Reverend Franklin was at, that all the number men were at, that all the business owners were at. If they were black, they were where you were. So to know, I know everybody that did anything at Motown, from the people who swept the floors to whoever the biggest star was. I've seen everybody there, either drunk or neck or broke or all three at the same time.
Early in your career, when you were in your 20s or early 20s, I think, one of your managers was killed and mm-hmm. another one disappeared.
Well, my first manager is the one that was killed, eventually died from the wound. Mary Wells' husband shot him. He was Eddie Floyd's uncle, and Eddie was one of the Falcons, and Robert West owned the Falcons, and he was my very first manager. And then it was a few years later that it was the record company owner of Cala Records who disappeared.
Wow, what a
yeah!
What a set of circumstances to be starting your career.
Yes, it and it's there's For every 5 years, there's an interesting story.
And how did it feel to you to be managed by people who were connected like that?
You wanted to be with them because they had all the connections. That's who you wanted to be with. But that was no big deal.
No, I think it was in the late 60s and early 70s that you were managed by someone named Jim Lewis who wanted you to learn jazz standards.
He got me at about 1967 or so, maybe 65.
This was after the guy who disappeared.
Yes.
Right.
And I came back to Detroit, and Jim Lewis was the assistant to the president of the Musicians Union. So he pretty much called all the shots musically in Detroit. So I had the opportunity to work with everyone who was working there, whether they wanted to work with me or not.
Jim
always wanted me to try out these, all of these standards with legitimate jazz musicians. So if they were working in the city and he was doing the gigs, he was running it, you know. She's going to be your singer this week. It was almost like working for the mafia. She's going to be your singer this week. And they, of course, didn't know how to handle those songs, Lover Man and all of that. But because he made me learn them, I was able to get gigs of all sorts. I was able to tap dance on Broadway with Cab Calloway because of what Jim made me learn.
This was in Bubbling Brown
about,
Sugar.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He thought, my manager thought nothing about the records that were, he said, not only can't you sing, none of your little friends can sing. And when he said my little friends, he meant Marvin Gaye and the Vandellas. He said, none of your little friends can sing. And he said, until y'all learn these songs, you won't be real singers. You won't be real stars. And they were all trying to learn them too, because that was the way we were raised. We were trying to come to Carnegie Hall or come to some big center or go to Las Vegas. And you weren't going to get there with the little stuff that we were recording. And that was the way he always thought of it. He thought, well, if I got a really big record, then that would be one thing. But until then, learn these real songs.
In 1969, you did a series of recordings that was supposed to be released on an album, but never was. Mm-hmm. Was this ever released at all until it was recently compiled on an album?
It was released on an album, in album form, in England, on Charlie Records, but never in America.
Okay, and in America, when it was recently reissued, it was called Take Another Little Piece of My Heart. In 72, you recorded an album that was never released until 2005. Mm-hmm. And this is a kind of famous album now.
It's more infamous
than famous. Thank you. Yeah. It was supposed to be released by Atlantic Records. It was recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, but it was never released. It just lay in the Atlantic vault until a French producer licensed it from Atlantic and released it in 2000. It was initially supposed to be called Child of the 70s. What were you expecting the outcome of this album to be?
Oh, I really thought I had everything, all the components that I thought would work. I had recorded it in Muscle Shoals, where all the hits were coming from. I had Wilson Pickett's producer, Brad Shapiro. It was on an Atlantic label. It had everything that was supposed to happen. And then it didn't. So all the thoughts right after that were suicidal.
What did they tell you when they didn't release it?
They said, send the tickets back. We've decided not to go forward with the project. Those were their exact words.
But you
I don't even know who it was that called me.
But you'd already finished recording it, hadn't you?
It was, I had the plane tickets to go on the road to promote it.
Oh, I see. I see.
They had already done everything.
Oh, wow. Well, this is good stuff. We should hear a track of it. I was thinking we could hear Your Turn to Cry. You want to say anything about the song or why it was chosen?
Oh, I just chose it here again because I liked it, but it was, I thought that it sounded up to that date better than anything I had ever recorded, and I was just completely confused as to why I said it. I kept comparing it to everything else that was out, and everything was just beginning to go stereo, too. So when all the new stereo albums started coming out, then it really didn't sound very good to me, and I kept trying to see myself. Why they wouldn't do it. And then over the years, I completely convinced myself that it wasn't good.
You were convinced that it wasn't good?
Mm-hmm.
okay, let's disprove that and play Your Turn to Cry. And this is from the 1972 Atlantic album that was never released until it was licensed by a French producer in 2000. And the French release is called Souvenirs. The subsequent American release of the album is called Child of the 70s.
Gave you all of my love, but you treated me like a fool. I even gave up right for wrong, trying to get along with you. When I wanted to hold you close, you were always too tired. Well, you had some place to go. Listen, Dad. Walking out that door, telling you goodbye. I can't take it no more. It's your time to cry. Oh, it's your time to cry. Oh, I tried staying with you because of...
That's Betty LeVette, recorded in 1972, and the song, the album that this song was recorded for has been subsequently released just a few years ago under the name Child of the 70s.
See, you and your audience are going to be as confused as I am.
Well, it must have been confusing to have things change on you like that.
Well, it's confusing now because I'm having to, most of it had been forgotten, and now I'm having to recall everything that happened just as if it was happening now or as if it happened just recently.
Well,
happened 30 and 40 years ago. So to just remember it all is just daunting.
Well, the other funny thing is that now you're being praised for the stuff that nobody wanted to even release.
Yeah.
You know, 35 years ago.
Yep.
That must be kind of confusing.
Well, it's... You know, to have all of this energy happening to you at 61 years old is, it's consuming. You know, it's taking virtually everything, every bit of energy that I have and everything that I've ever learned. But I'm glad that I have a lot of energy left and that I learned so doggone much because it's all coming in handy now.
Well, your new CD is called The Scene of the Crime. And the crime that you're referring to in The Scene of the Crime is the fact that after recording this album, it was never released. It just sat
right
in the Atlantic vault until 2000.
They didn't even know they had it.
They didn't know they had it.
They didn't even know they had it. They thought that it had been lost in a fire.
Oh.
And Gilles Pritchard came to New York and asked them, could he search for it physically? And he did.
He's the French producer who actually released it in 2000.
Yes, yes, who has been friends with me for almost 30 years. The first 15 or 20 years that we knew each other was strictly through correspondence. It was a long time before I met him. He got me a gig in Paris, and I finally got a chance to meet him.
So he actually had to physically search through the archives of Atlantic to find it?
I had a reel-to-reel copy of it. A friend at a studio here in New York stereorized my mono reel-to-reel version of it, and I let Gilles Pritchard hear it. He said, I've got to find this. It's got to come out. It's just got to come out. And he did.
One of the things you ended up doing in the 70s was a Broadway review that also had a road show called Bubbling Brown Sugar. And it was a review of blues and rhythm and blues songs.
Well, let's go back here now.
Yeah.
Bubbling Brown Sugar was a Tony Award-winning Broadway play. And it starred Honey Coles, Avon Long, who was a huge vaudeville star in the 20s and 30s, and Mabel Lee, who was in several black motion pictures. And then in the touring company, there was Honey Coles and Vivian Reed, whom I replaced. And then I went on to do several productions of the show with various people, but I got a chance to do one with Cab Calloway. And because those people were in the show and because there were so few young people who tap danced, it was one of the only times since the late 50s that all of these people had been able to work. And Cab Calloway and Honey Coles called everybody they knew to come and audition for the shows. So I got a chance to meet just a gang of people, like the real Bill Bailey, who is Pearl Bailey's brother, who was a great tap dancer in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and just people I had heard of all my life, and got a chance to work with them. And I'm probably the only person from my group who knows how to tap dance.
They taught you how to do it?
I had to learn how to do it and dance in a chorus line and wear a white tuxedo and a top hat and silver tap shoes.
Was that fun? Did you feel like yourself doing
it? I enjoyed it more than anything I've ever done in show business or ever will do again.
Wow.
It was the way I'd always imagined show business, because I started so young, I never had the opportunity to see a show other than in movies. And Bubbling Brown Sugar looked like the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers type things. Everybody in beautiful gowns and tuxedos and dancing and twirling me over the top of their heads. So it was extremely exciting.
Now, I want to hear something about your husband, because from what I've read, it sounds like your husband, Kevin Kiley, is like knows a whole lot about music and has a huge...
She knows more about it than I do.
And has a huge record collection. So I'm curious how you met. Was it through him finding, like, your recordings or something?
Well, he had known me because of my recordings and was a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the audacity to send me an email asking me not to record with this certain producer. Now, mind you, I had not had a record in 100 years. And here's this strange guy from New Jersey who's going to send me an email and say, don't let this guy record you because he's not good. I said, who the hell are you? Why are you telling me that? But it just turns out that I got a better deal. And my husband is as well as being a record collector and dealer, he also deals in depression glass. And was doing a lot of glass shows at the time, so he contacted me later on and told me he was coming to Detroit to do a glass show and wanted to meet me and apologize for being so forward. That's a lie, he said.
It's a pretty forward way of apologizing.
But that was really how it happened. He really knows. I mean, he knows more about black music than I would ever know. Really. He knows everybody black who has ever stepped up to a microphone.
So was he right about not doing the album with the producer who he didn't want you to work with?
Totally.
And is that why you didn't work with that producer? Or was
no.
Oh, okay.
I was going to work with him regardless. I didn't have any other deal, and Kevin didn't have a deal for me. So, no, I was going to do that. But just... This Betty LeVette luck stepped in, and I got Dennis Walker, who was a Grammy Award winner for the Robert Cray stuff, and the album that I did with him garnered me a W.C. Handy Award.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I want to congratulate you on the success that you're having now.
And, oh, thank you, baby.
Yeah, a long time coming, very well deserved. And
absolutely.
Thank you again, Betty LeVette, for being with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me.
Betty LeVette's new CD, The Scene of the Crime, has received a Grammy nomination for Best Contemporary Blues Album. Here's another track from it called I Guess We Shouldn't Talk About That Now.
Maybe we ought to think this through. Maybe we ought to tell the truth. This is the point of no return. I don't belong to you, but I guess we shouldn't talk about that now. Maybe we ought to close the door, shut out all